Good morning and welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. I'm here with my co-host, John Wells. This morning, we take a step into the science of the most common but the most mysterious procedure in medicine. For many of the 40 million Americans who undergo anesthesia each year, it is the source of great fear and fascination. We speak with Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, who has written a book called Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia.
Good morning, Lynn. Recently, Scientific American published an article by Melinda Wenner Moyer called Journey into Gunland. According to the article, hard numbers show that more firearms do not keep people safe. And why do so many Americans believe the opposite? Well, we'll speak with Moyer in the second half.
This is Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJuria Center at High Star Ranch, and ESCO Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's ESCO, E-S-C-O.
This is Chris Robinson with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. KPCW is one of the many nonprofits our agents and company support. They are the backbone of Summit and Wasatch counties in our incredible community. More info at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake here with John Wells. Well, 40 million Americans, yes, probably even you, who undergo anesthesia each year. We understand so little about it. Why do we blindly trust doctors who put us quite literally on the precipice between life and death into a coma and trust that it'll all come out okay? Our guest, Dr. Henry J. Prisbillo, is one such anesthesiologist who puts people in this position and one who would undergo anesthesia himself. He has administered the pain-numbing, coma-inducing gas to over 30,000 patients, and he's written a book to explore the most common but the most mysterious procedure in medicine with anecdotes, history, and, well, perhaps it'll help us understand a little more. His book is called Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. Dr. Prisbillo, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's I'm very, very gratified, and your interest in it is quite amazing. And I was actually trying to write down your introduction because I love the wording of it.
Oh, well, thank you. You know, what amazes me about you, and we were just talking about this before we came on air, is that it surprises me. You seem to be, and it's so obvious and evident in your book, a very compassionate doctor. And yet you're an anesthesiologist, one who barely speaks with his patients. What's behind that? Why did you choose anesthesiology over something else that gave you more face time with your patients?
Well, first of all, I appreciate your commenting on the compassion. I try to be, and I'm happy that you found that in the book. It wasn't a straightforward journey, the beautiful thing about anesthesia, and something that not a lot of people think about when they consider specialties in that, is that in anesthesia, it's probably the specialty, the single most specialty in all of medicine that allows you to forget the least from medical school. It is so expansive, not only in the quality and types of people that you're meeting, the types of diseases that they have, which may or may not be related to the procedure they're receiving, and then virtually every form of procedure you can imagine. So even though I'm not speaking to them for a very long period of time, the things that I'm doing behind those automatic double doors in my cloistered little anesthesia nest is really fascinating.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's interesting to me that we shop doctors. You know, we get a second opinion. But it seems to me, and I could be wrong, that we don't really shop anesthesiologists. Not to say that you're not a doctor, but, you know, other types of doctors, surgeons.
You're right on the button. Very, very few times are people searching for anesthesiologists. I'm I get a fair amount of requests. I'm not trying to break my arm, patting myself on the back, but I do. And one of the ways that it comes through is the person doing the procedure, the surgeon, the cardiologist, the gastroenterologist, who will tell patients, you know, this is who you want. The other way that I get a lot of referrals is from the nurses. And the nurses see me before and after each procedure, and they tend to tell families, patients, parents, you know, this is who you should be looking for. So I wish more people were looking for anesthesiologists to serve their needs, because you're right on. It is a very, very critical person in the procedure, and it's often forgotten. Now, flip that 180 degrees. The other thing that amazes me is how seldom I'm asked to refer a surgeon or procedurist, because nobody sees them like I see them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So both ways it's interesting.
Dr. Prisbelow, I was fascinated by the command center that you talked about setting up, which is basically, I don't know, 8 or 9 square feet of walking room at the head of the patient, where you have so much technology and so many options in front of you. It's where you navigate in the OR. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I call it my anesthesia nest. And I try to have everything I need for any circumstance within an arm's reach away. So it's a pretty tight space, but it has everything in there. The anesthesia machine is a behemoth, and I think I explained that in that chapter, that has so much on it, including all the monitors on the top and all the tracings, colors, and whatnot. But the things that it does have that I'm hoping will comfort patients, Every possible sign is monitored. Sorry, John, go ahead.
Oh no, please, you finish.
Every breath is monitored for my anesthetic gas plus oxygen plus the breathing out of the carbon dioxide inhale, everything. You know, blood pressure, heart rate, temperature, everything is on that screen.
I really enjoyed the history. I think going way back, somebody took fortified wine and mixed it with sulfuric acid, and that didn't work as well for keeping the patient out when someone was trying to do a surgery. But you tell the story of the introduction of ether. And what fascinated me about this was first of all, it was 170 years ago, and since then it has absolutely changed the way we provide healthcare, because now we can do surgeries where people are knocked out. But the other thing that interested me is that the spectacular exponential growth in technology and medical advancement, as far as the gases, there have been changes, but there haven't been that many changes in the 170 years, have there?
It's negligible changes to the drugs we used. The ether that was used in the 1840s, and it started as a party drug, and moved into medicine when somebody figured out that they could do things with it that were previously thought impossible. But that was that drug, diethyl ether. It had two carbons and an oxygen between, and now we're still using ethers. Except the side chains are a little bit different. The carbons are arranged a little different. Instead of two carbons on each side of the oxygen, it's one on one and three on the other side. The changes are really negligible. The other thing is there's nothing in the offing right now. And there's nothing in the offing because we're really not sure how the drug works, so we don't know what to target. And so right now I think we're at the end of the line of the inhalation drugs.
Wow. It's really fascinating to say, as someone who has done this for 3 decades, who's done 30,000 cases or times that you've administered the gases, that we don't really know how it works. But what do we know? And by that I mean, when you're administered anesthesia, is that all the numbing that you need for your body to not have a pain response even when you're in a coma-like state? Or I don't even know this. Are you administered some other numbing, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, there's a part in the book called the 5 A's. And what I did in that particular section was I deconstruct anesthesia. Now, the term anesthesia was introduced very shortly after the introduction of ether for painless surgery back in the late 1840s. And it was coined by Oliver Wendell Holmes, who used the Greek, without feeling. But it became understood as we progressed in our knowledge and our drugs that without feeling didn't cover it. And so there's different components that you try to attack, if you will, with an anesthetic or interact with an anesthetic. And they include anxiety, analgesia, which is pain relief, amnesia, which is loss of memory. Then I have a couple that are a little bit more vague to non-anesthesiologists, which is akinesia without movement. For instance, if you're clipping a brain aneurysm, it's absolutely imperative that that patient cannot move at all during that period. So I give them a paralyzing drug, and then I reverse the paralyzing drug. That's akinesia, no movement. And the final one is areflexia, which is a kind of adrenergic response, the fight-or-flight response. It's keeping heart rate, blood pressure, breathing all stable. And that's kind of lassoing the wind, but that's what I'm trying to do. So there's different drugs that can attack each of those or treat each of those. But the gas anesthetic, the one I'm using today, sevoflurane, is an all-in-one anesthetic. So you get all five of those at the appropriate dose of sevoflurane, but you don't need sevoflurane necessarily, at least all the time. You can use other things.
Mm. So folks who have undergone a lot of anesthesia, who may know post-surgery the types of complications that they experience, are they able to take those the five A's and go through, you know, and request a certain sort type of gas based on what they know to be their complications?
They certainly can, and I'm hoping that by people reading the book, they're going to understand that to come and ask questions. The other thing is that at the end of the book, and I'm patting myself too much, and I'm pumping my own book a little too heavily for my own liking, but it's an entire anesthetic experience. From the time a case is scheduled for anesthesia until the time you're discharged completely free of pain or as free of pain as possible, it gets the whole system. So the reader should understand the anesthetic process very, very well.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Henry Prisbolo, and he has written Counting Backwards, a Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. You are at the mercy of what your patient tells you, and you're talking to a four-year-old boy, Michael, whose mother is not there for some reason, to ask her if she gave him breakfast, and he tells you that he has had Captain Crunch cereal, and the nurse that you call, you keep calling back to the floor, she assures you that no, he has not had breakfast, and that he's good to go. And, of course, if you do eat before midnight, in this case, I think it was early in the morning that Michael is going to be operated on, you have the risk of aspiration, which is when the contents of your stomach can go down the trachea and you can die. So how do you navigate that?
Well, that was one very disturbed nurse with me. I thought she was going to bite my head off the last time I spoke to her. Insisting, no, he did not have it. No, he did not have it. I don't know how you can absolutely guarantee that the stomach is empty outside of assurances from the patient, from the family, from the parents, from the other staff. The issue, as you mentioned, is it can come back up because the anesthesia relaxes all the muscles, and so that what's ever in the stomach can come back up and it can go down into the airway. And it's not so much the contents itself, it's the acid that's produced when anything hits the stomach that's the real danger. And so that's a big problem. And you got to trust somebody, just like they have to trust me. I have to trust that they're being accurate in what they're telling me.
And as you mentioned in the book, acid is the anesthesiologist's enemy. I'll just read this quickly. The stomach is capable, this is something that you've written. The stomach is capable of withstanding the acid it produces as an acid in digestion, but other tissue is not immune to this acid. Herein lies risk the anesthesia, which relaxes muscles and turns off reflexes. And basically what you just said about the sphincter of the esophagus, or the sphincters, I guess there's a couple of them.
There's two. There's an upper and a lower, but more important, it's the voice box that whenever you have something in your mouth, your vocal cords close reflexively, except under anesthesia. They don't necessarily close anymore, and that's where the vocal cords are open, so whatever comes up into the mouth can go down.
And I don't think we told the listeners what actually happened. Yes, Michael had Captain Crunch, and yes, he started gurgling. Did he actually throw up? What happened, and what did you do?
It was one ERP, and the way I knew it was Captain Crunch is because I saw it. It was right there. Fortunately, he didn't take the breath in, so I was able to turn him on his side, suction him out, and there, but for the grace of God, go I. He didn't aspirate, but it was certainly a close call.
Mm. And you just should mention in that story, there's a little bit more, which is Michael was someone who underwent procedures quite often because he had a chronic condition. And your belief was that he was just trying to get the surgery postponed by telling you he had the Captain Crunch. You doubted the veracity of his of his story there. And
yes,
so,
exactly.
Which
and
is why you went
on,
to...
Oh, the look on his face was just incredible. It was, you know, the devil in him. You know, I had Captain Crunch, and then just nothing, not another word.
Yeah.
And he was hoping I was sending him back to the floor.
Yes. Well, you talk in your book about, and this is why your book is so, it's such an easy read. You talk a lot about these patients, and some of the stories, but there's this one time you show up after, I think, a three-day weekend, and you find a most unusual patient that you're about to administer anesthesia to. Talk about that one.
She was definitely the most unusual patient I've ever taken care of. It started on the Saturday, and the zoo had a great ape, a lowland gorilla named Tabibu, who became very, very ill, something going on in the belly. And so the zoo did not know what to do with her, and apes are very similar to humans, so they called over to the hospital and asked if one of our surgeons could do something. And the surgeon said, send the ape over to us, and we will take a peek at it. It turned out she had an infection in the belly that caused a hole in her intestines that had to be closed. And my partner took care of the ape for the actual anesthetic, Andy Roth. And he did a wonderful job, but as soon as the animal emerged from anesthesia, the zoo vet said, this is a wild animal, has to go back to the zoo immediately. Whenever you do procedure in the belly and on the intestines, they tend to stop working. And it takes a little while for them to start working. A little while can be several days. And so Tabibu went back to the zoo and didn't eat or drink, and on the Tuesday morning, she was back at the hospital, and she was near death. She was very, very shocky, high heart rate, blood pressure was okay, but it was about to go down and because she had taken nothing in. And so I was tapped on the shoulder and asked, could I help? And boy, that was an exciting help. When I entered the door, I just froze. You know, I mean, what do you do when you come into a room and there's a gorilla laying on the table? She was beautiful. Mm. And there, again, you know, there's no amount of skill that can replace dumb luck. I managed to get the IV in the only vein that I could possibly see, and we resuscitated the animal. I intubated it as I put a breathing tube in through her mouth into her trachea. We breathed for her several days. We slowly turned her around, and a few days later, she woke up, and we pulled out the endotracheal tube. One of the amazing things about Tabibu is that I got to take my daughter to see her. You know, how many people can claim that you touched a great ape? Tabibu loved to have her upper lip rubbed. You know, people could just do that for a half hour, an hour, and there was my daughter rubbing this great ape's lip, and it was magnificent. And then Tabibu woke up, and she went back to the zoo. And I got to see Tabibu one more time about a month later than that, but this time with a thick glass between us. And then I thought Tabibu would be sterile from the infection and the surgery. And it turned out she was transferred from Chicago to the Columbus Zoo. And I just looked her up recently, and I am very, very happy to say Tabibu had a little boy, JJ, about a year ago. Now, to put the stranger than fiction twist to this, and I hope I'm not running on too long, but Tabibu's little boy's name is JJ, and my name is Jay, and Tabibu's JJ was born on my birthday.
What a great story.
It's so, a great ending.
Well, and part of you equated Tabibu, in a sense, to you specialize in pediatric cases of anesthesia, and so you sort of compared her to an 18-month-old. Could you
Correct.
Talk a little bit about what it's like. It just must be heart-wrenching to see these babies and putting them under anesthesia. Describe that for us.
It can be, but I'll tell you, it's also so rewarding. And that's what keeps me coming back day after day. You know, I was asked the question, why did I want to do children and not adults? And it's a horrible reason, but when I was up during the night taking care of adult cases, almost always they did it themselves. There was a lot of impairment, a lot of alcohol. They were always doing silly things that caused them to be in the operating room in the middle of the night. But a child never, ever asks to get sick, doesn't ask to get hurt. So 24/7, I'm good to go on any child, and I with pride come in and take care of them. But when you feel good, you feel so, so good. And the number of times that I actually lose is pretty small compared to the number of times I feel very, very good. So that keeps me going.
Most of the stories of your career are about children, and there is a tremendous compassion there. So I really appreciate it reading about the front end of the surgeries and how hard you work to make them comfortable. So, mm-hmm. Good stories. I wanted to go back to Michael for a moment.
Sure, please.
And this has nothing to do with your book. It's more of just a general question. Michael's mother was not there, and you couldn't check
Correct.
To see if he had had breakfast or not.
Correct.
I don't know why she wasn't there, and you probably don't either. How often, though, does this happen?
You know, I'm in a take-all hospital, and unfortunately, there's a tremendous amount of kids that get dropped off by somebody, and there aren't many visitors. And, that's just the way it is in the inner city. So it happens more often than I want it to, but every child is treated exactly like my own, and just FYI, I anesthetized my own daughter, so I know what I'm talking about. So it doesn't matter if there's a parent there or not. They're getting the same care.
Oh, of course. Of course. And this is a science and technology show, and besides not a lot going on with ether and the gases over the years, you mentioned that ultrasound technology to more accurately place local anesthetics on nerves for prolonged pain relief has grown greatly. Talk
right.
about that a little bit. You know, everybody I know, almost everybody I know, has a bad back. Is this used in that case?
It can be. Yeah, it can be used in those cases. The back is a little bit different because the ultrasound doesn't penetrate bones a lot, and there's a lot of bones in close proximity to the spine. So it's a little bit harder, but you can do it. You can look for the windows, the places where there isn't the bone to get to the spine, and you can certainly place catheters with it. Even more so, the further you go out from the spine, the less complications there are doing nerve blocks. Not that there's much complications with spinal anesthetics and epidurals. And, you know, today, most women across this country, at least I believe so, I know in this area, most women for deliveries are getting epidurals. So it's a very, very good technique. It's a very safe technique, but it's even a little safer. So if I want to do something, if there's a surgeon who wants to operate on the knee and I want to do something to help him get that done, there's a couple of nerves right behind the knee and a little bit above that I can take that ultrasound, I can locate them, I can put local anesthetic on it, block all sensation to it, and so now I can totally avoid the gas if necessary, and I can use other medications to take care of the anxiety, any additional analgesia relief necessary, and I can even give drugs that'll cause a gentle sleep and cause amnesia. So you know, we can do the building blocks, especially as we get out from the head out from the spine.
Mm. Nitrous oxide, the
yes.
happy gas, laughing gas
yep.
we get
laughing
when we go to the dentist. What is the difference between the type of gases that you use and something like nitrous oxide? Is it just a stronger dose?
Yes, it's stronger. Matter of fact, one of the mildly fascinating stories about anesthesia is not long before the first demonstration of ether for painless surgery in 1846, another person tried to use laughing gas and they had a demonstration and failed. And that's because the potency of nitrous oxide just isn't strong enough. For instance, if you want to get a strong anesthetic level of nitrous oxide on, it has to be 106% of your gas. gas, which is impossible. But with our volatile anesthetics, the ethers that I use, you know, a couple of percent in inspired air is enough to give a good anesthetic level. So the potency is very different to nitrous. It's a nice bump, but it's not complete.
Okay. And I have to ask you this before we go. I didn't read your book in its entirety, so I don't know if you address this. But because you're such a compassionate-seeming person, I have to ask, you know, you hear those stories about some amount of consciousness that people have while under anesthesia, or at least they believe they do. They believe that they have somehow heard conversations or, you know, especially they talk about negative conversations that take place in the operating room. What do you think about that? And what do you think about the consciousness, if any, that there exists?
I think it's most likely due to lack of vigilance, which is a motto of anesthesiologists, on the person providing the care. Let's go back for a second to the deconstructing. So we have that patient for the knee procedure, and I've done the knee block, the popliteal fossa block, and block those nerves so that there's no sensation around that knee. And now we gave a little something for anxiety, so I give a Valium-like drug, a benzodiazepine, to calm down a little bit, but not enough to create a loss of memory. So that person is hearing what's going on in the room. They're comfortable, but they hear what's going on in the room. So you have to have a certain depth of anesthesia. You have to have enough of the ether gases. The sevoflurane has to be at a certain percentage to prevent memory formation, or you have to cover it with other drugs to make sure that there isn't any memory. So they just let those drugs get a little too low, a little too light, and there's the memory.
I've got AFib, and my cardiologist in Boston is—he's like the coolest guy I know. He's really relaxed. I have a lot
of
confidence.
They're pretty neat guys.
Yeah, they are. And so I was having one of those procedures when they go up through the leg,
right.
and they're killing the errant cells to try to
get
me back in rhythm.
Right.
And I woke up on the operating table, and I'm looking around, and it's, first of all, there was a tremendous amount of pain in my heart because he had a laser there burning these cells.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked up, and I've never, for a cool guy, this guy's sweating. And he's saying, no, and I remember the nurse saying, doctor, it's been 2 hours and 45 minutes. He says, we're not leaving till we get this last one. And he was kind of stern about the whole thing. But they saw me, and I started asking a couple of questions, and they knocked me out right away. So I'm not sure what happened, but how often does that happen? Somebody wakes up?
Well, you know, the first thing I would ask you is, did you have an anesthesiologist? Because very, very frequently when you go into the cardiac cath lab, especially in adults and especially for AFib, you're getting sedation. So somebody's giving you some level of drugs, but it's not an anesthesiologist. So that would be the first thing is, were you sure you had an anesthesiologist? If you have an anesthesiologist, they are really focused solely on your overall well-being, making sure that you're comfortable, but making sure, first of all, you're safe. So that's when you get into sedation and now you don't have an anesthesiologist, you have a little bit of everybody doing everything. And I kind of call it the difference between a toggle light switch and a dimmer switch. When you're having sedation, it's a dimmer switch, and everybody's got their fingers on that switch. But when you're under anesthesia with me, it's a toggle switch. It's all or none, and I'm the only one with the fingers on the switch. So it's a question of who had control of you that I would say. And, oh, by the way, your procedure, ablation of the aberrant pathway,
yes,
or the bad cells, it's like looking for a needle in the haystack. You know, there's a little clump of cells in that heart that's causing the problem, and they haven't a general idea. But you know, you're taking a tiny little probe, and you're trying to find that tiny little clump of cells, and it just takes a lot of time and patience.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
A very interesting book. Our guest, Dr. Henry J. Prisbolo. And the book is called Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
I enjoyed it.
So did we. Take care.
Bye.
And Dr. Prisbolo, okay, that's spelled Przybylo, if you happen to search for that. The title of the book, Counting Backwards. Stay with us. We'll be back in a few moments after these words from our underwriters. It's Cool Science Radio.
This is Beth, owner of Peak Art and Frame, local sponsors of Cool Science Radio on KPCW. Locally owned and operated, Peak Art and Frame offers local artwork as well as digital printing, custom framework, and mirrors. Open Monday through Saturday and located in the Walmart Shopping Center, 649-0801 or peakartandframe.com.
Hi, this is Shelley Barris, Executive Director of Habitat for Humanity. Have you been to our ReStore lately? You will find treasures every visit because we receive new donations of furniture, appliances, and building materials daily. Even better, your purchases support local hardworking families. We are a nonprofit and proud to be a KPCW supporter.
Earl Foote here with Nexus IT, happy to keep KPCW Radio and their staff running smoothly. We provide sales and maintenance on all computer systems and can guide our customers about cloud solutions for their businesses or personal computer needs. More info available at 435-487-9099 or nexusitc.net.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. We're just speaking with Dr. Belisbo, Henry J. Belisbo, who wrote the book Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. We're now going to be speaking with our second guest. Guns took more than 36,000 lives in 2015, and this and other alarming statistics have led many to ask whether our nation would be better off with firearms and fewer hands. Yet gun advocates argue exactly the opposite, that murders, crimes, mass shootings happen because there aren't enough guns in enough places. Arming more people will make our country safer and more peaceful, they say, because criminals won't cause trouble if they know they're surrounded by gun-toting good guys. These are the words written by our next guest, Melinda Wenner Moyer, who counters that argument in an article published in Scientific American in October called Journey to Gunland. She joins us now. Melinda, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it was quite an article, and the gun advocates, as I mentioned in the introduction, their narrative is that, yeah, murders, crimes, and mass shootings happen because there aren't enough guns, and you've taken a look at 30 studies, a number of studies, that show that more guns are linked to more crimes, that, you know, more guns, more people die. Why did you write this article?
Well, you know, I was actually approached by Scientific American to write it, and I'm a science writer. I usually write about microbes and, yeah, and things like that, right? So I said, gosh, you know, I don't know a lot about guns, but of course, you know, guns can be studied and the effects of guns can be studied just like anything else by scientists, and I recognize that this is a hugely important issue. So I said, you know, this is a little outside my comfort zone, but yes, I want to learn more about this. I want to dig into the research. I really didn't know what the research said. And then, you know, 6 months later, came out the other side with this article.
It's fascinating looking at the two sides, the way they're set up, and they can draw facts to support anything that they want, but there's a tremendous amount of facts now on the gun control side. What is it with the two groups that we can't get them together?
Yeah, this is such a charged issue, and I think it's such an emotional issue. So I don't have a lot of experience with guns myself, and I realize that I kind of needed to understand why people feel so strongly about their guns, you know, protecting them. So I went to a shooting range as part of my reporting, and I have to say I was terrified before I shot the Glock 19. And then as soon as I did, there was kind of this transformation. I went from really scared and nervous to feeling really empowered and exhilarated and sort of invincible almost. And you know, I kind of realized at that point, yes, like I get why people think that their guns would protect them. They're very powerful. So I get the sense that people have, you know, I talked to a lot of people for this article, people have strong emotional relationships with their guns, and they, you know, they deep down really believe that their guns can protect them. And on, you know, on top of that, we have the NRA's messaging, which, you know, sort of confirms that, and we have confirmation bias, which is sort of this process by which we tend to interpret information that supports what we believe and sort of dismiss information that doesn't. And I think it's just led to this very strong and pervasive belief about guns, you know, saving lives rather than taking lives.
Melinda, it's interesting to me that you started this research not having a position on gun control or gun ownership. You knew not a lot about it. Do you think that made you less biased, more objective?
Well, I think it's hard to not have any opinion on this as an adult in the U.S., right? So I'm aware that we all come to big political issues like this with some sort of preconceived ideas. And I think I'm no exception to that. I could not have been entirely indifferent and unbiased. But as a science reporter, there have been many times when I've sort of had an idea about something and then reported the issue deeply and done a complete 180 where I realized, oh, I was actually really wrong about this thing. And so I was aware that that could be the case with this issue, and I tried to keep an open mind. I tried to make sure that I was reading studies on both sides of the issue, that I was talking to people on both sides of the issue, including the NRA. And, you know, I also really didn't know what the research said. I knew that there were strong opinions, and I thought, you know, I had an idea about what the research might say, but I really didn't know. And so so I was, you know, learning about it for the first time in that sense. And it was pretty convincing. I mean, this is an issue that, you know, guns are really hard to study, actually, because you think about people who buy guns or carry guns or own guns, they can often be very different from people who don't decide to buy guns or carry guns. There can be demographic differences, socioeconomic differences, just different circumstances in life, right? Mm-hmm. And different choices that you're making. And so if you're trying to tease out, you know, what is the actual effect of that gun rather than the other differences and different choices that people with guns might make, you know, it's really hard to tease out. So, but yet, scientists have kind of figured out, I mean, they're very clever people, and they've figured out how to ask this question in different ways. And so, you know, they've looked at states and counties and cities that have a lot of guns and compared their violence statistics and crime statistics to places that don't have a lot of guns. They've also looked at what happens in places that have changes in gun control laws that either make it easier or harder to get guns, and also, you know, changes in laws that make it easier for people to get permits to carry concealed, and, you know, how does that affect crime? How do those changes affect crime over time? And looking at people who've been victims of crime, are they more or less likely than people who aren't victims of crime to have owned guns? And so they've been able, and they use a lot of statistical controls to try to weed out the effects of other choices and differences between people who have guns and people who don't. And largely, these studies, which really try to get at this question in so many different ways, they've all kind of pointed in the same direction. There are certainly some studies that are exceptions, that are anomalies, that point the other way, but most of them suggest that where you have more guns, you have more crime and more violence.
And so I'm wondering, where does the mental health component come into this? Because when you speak to the gun lobby, they say it's not the guns that kill, it's the people who do. And mental health is what needs to be addressed, which I think most everyone would agree with. It's a mental illness that leads people to perform mass shootings. It's not the gun itself. However, where does mental health figure into the research that you studied?
Yeah, so mental health diagnoses, from what I understand, are not always good predictors of behavior. So just a diagnosis of, you know, schizophrenia, it's not, people who have this diagnosis are not necessarily violent, right? So a lot of researchers say we shouldn't be looking at diagnostics here, but we should be looking at prior behavior. So people who have engaged in violent behavior before, those people should be restricted from having guns or purchasing guns. And so, you know, I think it's difficult because you also, there's the risk that you might marginalize people with mental health issues who, you know, as I said, a lot of the very vast majority of people who have mental health issues are not violent. So it's complicated. It's very difficult.
Well, if you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Melinda Wenner Moyer. She's written an article in Scientific American titled Journey to Gunland. Well, a lot of people know the name Trayvon Martin. He was killed by George Zimmerman in Florida in 2012 on the Stand Your Ground law, which basically the law allows people to kill in self-defense when they feel they are in danger. How has this law affected homicides, deaths in Florida and in other states that have enacted the Stand Your Ground laws?
Right. So this is an example of a type. There have been studies that have looked at what has changed after laws like this have been passed. And so in Florida, after Stand Your Ground was passed in it was actually a January 2017 study that came out, found that monthly homicide rates in Florida went up by nearly a quarter after the law was passed. And there have been some other studies that have looked at several different states and the effects that Stand Your Ground laws have had on several different states and found, again, that there was an increase in homicides relative to other states. So it looks as though these laws actually make it more likely that people are going to be killed rather than less.
Yeah, so it makes it easier to kill more people.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does. It does make sense. And on the political side, it was fascinating to read in your article that after the 2012 school shooting that took the lives of 20 children and 6 adults in Newtown, Connecticut, President Obama signed an executive order requesting the CDC spend $10 million on gun violence research, but Congress, they did not appropriate those funds, and that was to study gun violence. So is that the basic political argument, or is that the basic political stance, is that the folks that are pro-gun are trying to stop these types of studies and discussions?
Yes, and there's a long history of this happening. So back in the 90s, when some of the first big splashy studies came out that suggested that gun ownership was linked to an increased risk of being murdered, the NRA did not like these studies. And actually, they wrote an article. The NRA wrote an article that they printed in their journal, The American Rifleman, that urged NRA members to ask their representatives to stop allowing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the agency that was funding a lot of these gun violence studies, basically asking that Congress defund the CDC because the CDC was funding, very biased work, the NRA said. They said, these are studies that are designed to come to the conclusion that guns are bad, and, we implore you, NRA members, to demand that the CDC not be allowed to fund these kinds of studies. So fast forward to 1996, and Jay Dickey, a representative from Arkansas, introduced a rider into a funding bill for the CDC that said that the CDC was not allowed to fund studies that promote gun control. Now, the thing is, the CDC wasn't really funding studies to promote gun control. The CDC was funding studies to understand gun violence and the factors that lead to gun violence. But at the time, this rider was interpreted by CDC staff, who I talked to a number of them for my piece, as a kind of threat, saying, look, if you keep publishing these studies, we are going to defund you. We are going to defund your entire injury center, and you're not going to have money to do any research. And this fear at the CDC has continued. I mean, and up to, as you said, in 2012, after the Newtown massacre, after Obama asked for $10 million on gun violence research, Congress said no. And somebody who was at the CDC at that time, who was directing the CDC's injury center, said that staff were explicitly told that they couldn't talk to the media about Newtown, and they couldn't even mention the word gun when they spoke to the media. So they've just been terrified.
Wow. So more than 30,000 people are killed by guns each year in this country. That's more than die of AIDS and about the same number that die in car crashes or from, say, liver disease. And you may have heard this story just last night on NPR talking about the same thing with the CDC and not funding research into gun violence. Those are some pretty staggering numbers to think that we don't allow our healthcare practitioners to even use the word to even talk about guns. And those of the gun lobby would say, well, there are this many people that die in car crashes, but we don't disallow people from purchasing cars. We just try to make them safer. From your research, what are we doing to make guns safer?
Well, I didn't come across a whole lot. There are some efforts underway to develop sort of, smart guns that only fire when their owners have picked them up. But most of these efforts are not appreciated by the NRA. It seems as though most efforts to make guns safer are cited by the NRA as, this is just the first step in a very slippery slope. That everybody just wants to take your guns. We can't give them an inch, or they will take all of our guns away. And I have to say, I spoke with a number of researchers who study gun violence and who study policies that could reduce gun violence, and not one of them said that they have any interest in taking everybody's guns away. I mean, that wouldn't be feasible. And they respect the right of law-abiding people to own and keep guns. They just want to find ways to keep guns out of the hands of people who are most likely to commit gun crimes. And so, there's a lot of research that has been done to try to find policies that could both, respect and allow gun-abiding people to have their guns, but limit access to people who are most likely to be violent. But the NRA really strongly pushes back against it, and they give a lot of money to politicians who then also say, no, we don't want any of these. It's a slippery slope.
Yeah, that's a bit of a fallacy of an argument, I believe. And I wonder how, with the gun lobby and the NRA so strong, and funding so many politicians, did you find any numbers about how many of these politicians actually own guns themselves?
No, that's a very interesting question. I don't know that, and I wonder whether anybody has studied that. One thing that's interesting about gun data is it's very hard to come by. Again, the NRA has a lot to do with this, but it's almost impossible to know who owns guns and where they are and how many guns people own, because this kind of data just isn't kept anywhere. A lot of times these studies have to use bizarre proxies to sort of guess at how many guns a particular state might have or a particular city might have, because there's really just no central information on where, who's purchasing guns and where they're ending up.
You say in your article that interviews that you did, that you conducted in heavily gun-owning towns show they're not as wedded to the crime defense idea as the gun lobby claims.
Yes. So it was interesting. I was down south reporting for this piece, and I talked to a lot of people who have guns and believe in the right of people to have guns. And a lot of them said, we think the NRA has gone a little too far. We don't think everybody should be carrying guns. We don't think, we think that universal background checks and other measures that would make it harder for criminals to get guns, we fully support that, even though the NRA doesn't. And the town of Kennesaw, Georgia, which I visited, which is an interesting town because it passed a law in 1982 mandating that its residents all own guns and ammunition, which was really it was more of a political statement than anything else, but the idea was that, well, if everybody in Kennesaw owns a gun and everybody knows that, then nobody's going to try to break into homes in Kennesaw. Nobody's going to cause trouble. Even those, the police officers I spoke to in Kennesaw said, you know, we advocate for safe storage of guns, which, again, is something that the NRA, you know, doesn't support laws in support of safe storage. So, yes, there's a lot more moderate opinions than I expected going down into the South, and a lot of divergence from NRA stance.
Well, Melinda, thank you for joining us this morning. What are you currently working on now?
That's a good question. I'm actually waiting to hear back from some editors. I've sent some pitches in. I write about a lot of different stuff. I also write about parenting, so I just wrote a piece on how sexism develops in childhood, how children develop differences of opinion about the genders. So that's been interesting. I'm all over the place.
Okay, we're going to keep our eye on you and see what's going on. Melinda Wenner Moyer has written for Scientific American in October an article called Journey to Gunland. Thanks for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, we shall return in a couple of minutes. We're going to go to some underwriters, and we'll be back with some final thoughts.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m., reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Here with John Wells. I want to thank our guest today, Melinda Moyer, as well as Dr. Henry J. Presbolo, his book, Counting Backwards, A Doctor's Notes on Anesthesia. And hey, JW, we have just a moment to talk about the Music Crawl, which regrettably I will miss this weekend being out of town. But tell me, what I'm going to miss.
Well, you're going to miss a good time. It's right before the tourists come into town. We love tourists, but this is our last opportunity to have local people like you and I and local bands and local venues to be able to have a celebration. So the KPCW Main Street Music Crawl starts at 7:30 on Saturday night, this Saturday, the 18th. And you can start at OP Rockwell, at Flanagan's, or at the Spur. You get your tickets by going to kpcw.org and then designating where you're going to start your crawl. You can also go to any of those three doors and buy a ticket, you know, real time in person, but it'll be more expeditious if you do it online. So buy your tickets and join us.
And so what does the ticket give you? It gives you entry, and does it give you drinks? Or?
Yeah, so if you buy it online, you will, for $35, you'll get two chits that will allow you to get drinks in any of the three bars. If you do this in person, you only get one chit, and then there's some other pricing options as the night wages on into later hours. But there'll be five bands in those three venues, again, OP Rockwell, Flanagan's, and the Spur, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
I have heard in previous years, and for some reason I've been out of town, each year you've done it. This is the third year.
Yeah.
But people go in big groups, and you dress up. How do you dress?
Yeah, you dress Park City eccentric, Park City fun, Park City nutty. You know, just have some fun with it. We always have some interesting costumes, and just people just having fun.
All right. Well,
and it is a fundraiser for KPCW. That's the important thing.
That's right. Well, thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. It's KPCW Park City. Thanks to our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, Peak Art and Frame, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Park City Mountain, San Francisco Design, Nexus IT, and the Habitat for Humanity Restore.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long, Reimer, Weiniger, Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.